So tonight we'll continue looking at the Four Noble Truths by looking at the Second Noble Truth. Remember that the First Noble Truth basically says that life as we live it is unsatisfactory. That's my preferred definition. Translation of the word, the Pali word dukkha. It just doesn't seem to work somehow or other. We can't, no matter what we do, construct a life so that we're happy all the time. And so the Second Noble Truth answers the question, well, why is that? what is it? And I want to point out, it's very important that we understand that the First Noble Truth isn't negative. It isn't like, oh, everything's horrible. It's just realistic. It's just, this is how life is. No matter what we say, what we do, what we try, it just doesn't work to be, we don't find happiness all the time. And that's just to look at things as real. I mean, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha instructs us to know dukkha as it really is. And that's look at it realistically, look at your life realistically. And so the next sutta explains. The next truth explains why this suffering, using the traditional translation, is inevitable in a sense. And so the Second Noble Truth says, he knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. This is why this unsatisfactoriness, this suffering, this unhappiness keeps arising in our lives. And we come across another Pali word here, and that's tanha. Now, we have to be careful because tanha, you often see translated as desire, which is not a very good translation. Desire is actually pretty neutral. You know, desires can be wholesome. You had a desire to come and hear the teachings of the Buddha tonight. This is a wholesome desire. You know, it can also be unwholesome, or they can be neutral. Like, you know, I want to, you know, move my foot from there to there. That's a desire. And just as like, well, because you got to move your foot from there to there, it's not like a big deal. It's just you're walking. So you have that desire to move the foot. Totally neutral. So tanha isn't so much desire as grasping or craving. These are two other translations I like much better. There's this sense of desperation, this sense of, I gotta have it, and I gotta have it right now. Or I wanna get away from that. This is also grasping. Another translation you see is for tanha is thirst. And thirst is an unsatisfied longing. When you look it up in the dictionary, not just thirst for like liquid, thirst in the broad emotional sense, it's an unsatisfied longing. Pretty good description of tanha. Now, what's the problem with this? What's the problem is that grasping, craving, leads pretty quickly to what in the tradition is called clinging, where it's not like we're not just reaching out for something now or trying to push something away, we're actually grabbing a hold of something and holding on to it real tight. So if it's something we want to hold on to it and make it permanent. We don't want it to go away. I want to hold on to this because I'm going to grip it really tightly. I'm going to cling to it. So that makes sense with something we want, but how does it make sense when it's something we don't want, when we're pushing something away? Well, think about what happens to actually push something away. You have to make quite a strong contact with it. You have to cling to it, get a really good hold of it before you can fling it out into space. Right? So you need, in both cases, whether it's you want it or you don't want it, we have to make a very strong contact with it. We have to cling to it. And this is, this grasping and clinging is the cause of all the unsatisfactoriness. It seems so simple, but that's the way it is. And there's a really important teaching of the Buddha I want to mention here, sort of peripherally. And this is, I'll call it, you know, the 12 steps of codependent arising, where things start from our day-to-day experience point of view. It's something arises at one of the six sense doors. Something happens, a thought, a taste, a touch, a smell, etc. And then right following that event, what arises is something called Vedana, which is roughly translated from the Pali as feeling tone. So it isn't feeling like feelings, like we have feelings for something. Feeling tone is like this very subtle mental arising that occurs directly after we experience something at one of the sense doors that only has three flavors: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. When it's pleasant, we want to grasp it and cling to it to keep it. We want, gee, that was nice. I want more. I want to have that all the time. And when it's unpleasant, we grasp and cling to push it away. So whether we get an unpleasant or a pleasant Vedana, the reaction is the same. It leads to clinging. If it's neutral, here's the interesting thing about neutral. Neutral is like, it's so boring. Neutral is boring. And we just immediately go looking for something else to pay attention to that has some charge to it. Whether that charge is pleasant or unpleasant, almost we don't care. I need some juice here. That's how we react to neutral Vedana. So in all three cases, we lead to this space of clinging. And so this is how we operate in the world, how we normally operate in the world. Just things arise, we cling to them. And then, of course, because everything's impermanent, these things we're clinging to go away. It's inevitable because we understand from looking at the First Noble Truth, that everything's impermanent. Everything is always changing all the time. So no matter how tightly we cling to something, no matter how much we want to make it permanent, it goes away. It's gone. And then we're unhappy. So as a method for finding happiness, clinging doesn't seem very effective. Doesn't work. So what we need to do is look at what it is we cling to, or the ways we cling. And it's taught that there are four sort of layers of clinging, or four aspects of clinging. The first of these is we cling to pleasure, sense pleasures through objects. You know, we cling to something that's arisen at one of our sense doors that's, I really like that, or I really don't like that. Strong reactions either way. We cling to them because we think somehow that's the next hit of that sensory experience will be the one that lasts, that makes us permanently happy. That somehow or other, we're going to find something that is just like, this is it. I found everything I need that's wonderful, and now I'm going to be happy all the time. It's like we somehow believe that if we can just somehow create this world around us where only pleasurable things occur, if we can just get the right combination of things and all the unpleasurable things, they never occur anymore, then we'll be happy. That's what our mind keeps telling us. And there are even moments when we do actually get close to achieving that. We find just the right sense of, we're hiking in the mountains and we got lots of fresh air and we're with a really nice person and it's sunny and we sit down on this rock that's really comfortable and we look at the view and the view is sensational and everything is just like perfect. And then along comes some guy yakking on his cell phone, walking right by where we're sitting. This is a personal example of what happens to me. But things change. No matter what you do, no matter how perfect you think everything is, things change. It's inevitable. So no matter if we can get that perfect combination of stuff, it's going to change. It doesn't last. It's like just like that. And so that's part of it. I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book here, called The Experience of Insight. And this is a story he tells about someone named Mullah Nasruddin, a famous Sufi teacher. So Mullah Nasruddin, one day he went to a marketplace and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciple came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, mullah, why do you go on eating them?" As he reached for another one, Mullah Nasruddin replied, "I keep waiting for a sweet one." But that's how we think. We think somehow in this basket of hot peppers hidden someplace, there's going to be a sweet one. But of course, there isn't. It doesn't work. No matter how much we try, it just doesn't work. So that's the first thing we cling to. We cling to sensual pleasures. It's the one we most normally, when we think about this on a casual sort of way, that's what we think of this teaching is about. But actually, there's three more layers here, and they get progressively more interesting as far as I'm concerned. The second one is views. What we cling to is what is often called views and opinions. This is partly intellectual, partly cultural. It's how we live and how we are brought up. This is like ideas we have about how things should be or how things are. This is the right way, the true way, the correct way, or this is just how things are. I know that this is how things are. These are like these views and opinions act like filters on reality. Instead of seeing things as they really are, we see everything through one or more of these filters that we hold this idea to be true. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. There we are, right? In the Constitution, right? That's what happens. We think, well, of course, everybody knows this is true. And of course, what really happens is some people think that's true and some people think the opposite's true. And that's their experience, as a matter of fact. You know, so we... And the thing about views and opinions, of course, is that when something happens where something goes against our views and opinions of how things should be and what the right way to do things are, we get upset. Because now things aren't right anymore. Things are the way, aren't the way they should be. This person isn't acting the way they should towards me. Or this country isn't acting the way they should towards us, you know, on a larger level. Or, you know, the people of that race, they're just all really dirty. And they don't act the way us normal people do, us good people do. Or. So these views and opinions could be on a huge range of topics and ideas. The problem with this is these things are often so deeply held because we grew up in a certain way, or we have come in contact with a certain cultural viewpoint, or whatever. They seem natural. Well, of course, that's the way it is. So we don't ever pause to even question them. It's because we don't even see them as anything other than in the background, the way things are. We lose sight of the fact these are simply views and opinions, just ideas that we have of how things should be. They're so often very subtle, and often, you know, especially things, you know, cultural things that are things we grew up with, are so deeply embedded in our minds that it's like we don't even realize that they're there. But they're filtering, literally filtering what we're actually experiencing. They're like, you know, rose-colored glasses, that expression. You know, we don't see things as they really are because they're filtered by these views and opinions. So how can we catch these things? If we're trying to not cling, what can we do about this? One of the big indicators, if you see thoughts of this nature arising, you know, well, of course it's that way. Or that's just the way it is, and it always has been that way. Or I know I'm right. There's a real good clue that that's a view or an opinion. I know I'm right. And think of all the times we get into situations with people where what's at the root of that, the difficulty between us is I know I'm right and they're wrong. Not only am I right, they're wrong. And of course, they think exactly the opposite. They know they're right. There's all the suffering arising just like that. Instead of being able to look, step back and go, oh yeah, well, yeah, I think this and I see you think that. And these can both be, obviously be valid ways of looking at it. They're just two different views. Being able to step back and see that sense of rightness, often of self-righteousness, if we're not careful in the more extreme cases, is just us clinging to a view or an opinion. That's all. It's hard to accept as well, because we don't like to think of ourselves as wrong in this way. I mean, and the word wrong comes up, but it's not even wrong. It's just like so programmed. How could this be not be true? And I believe this so strongly. We don't want to let go of these views and opinions, because to let go of them is like admitting we've been acting and speaking and doing things in a certain way that may not be that skillful. It's based on these views and opinions. So they're hard to let go of, hard to see. And when you do see them, they're then hard to let go of. But, and this is a lot of where a lot of us get caught. There's a great saying of the third Zen patriarch I like in this context. The Zen patriarch, the third Zen patriarch was famous for these pithy, brief sayings, teachings. And this one is, do not seek the truth. Pretty radical thing to say. Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Whoa. Because we do. We cherish these opinions, right? Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. This is a direct teaching about how to work with views and opinions skillfully. So the third thing we cling to, this is sort of almost, I sometimes think of this as like a special subset of views and opinions. And it's rites and rituals. In the time of the Buddha, in North India at the time he lived, the whole culture was of the Brahmanic culture, where the Brahmins believed that everything, literally everything that had to get done or be done, or there was a correct ritual that you could perform with certain rites, you know, sacrificing a calf or whatever, you know, throwing the right herbs on the fire at the right moment, that would somehow take care of things. Everything could be taken care of by following very strictly these rites and rituals. And of course, these rites and rituals could only be performed by the Brahmins. So they had like a corner on the market, right? And this was a very strongly held belief, not only by the Brahmins, but by all the other people who felt somehow that the Brahmins, because they'd always been right, well, of course, that's the way it is, you know. This was how things were. And the Buddha, when he was teaching, basically just said, "Vah humbug, what a bunch of nonsense," which of course really upset the Brahmins. And just said, no, you don't need any of that stuff. You just need to do this practice. That's it. You don't need the Brahmins to bless it. You don't need anybody to bless you. You don't need Brahmins to, you know, make sure it rains at the right time after you plant your crops or whatever all these rituals were. It's totally unnecessary. And it hampers you because it means that you now have no agency. You're always dependent totally on someone else. So that's the Brahmanic culture 2,500 years ago. What about our culture today? Well, there are certainly lots of people in our world who are still very devoted to rites and rituals as being the solution for everything. You know, a lot of traditional religious practice has to do with rites and rituals. And think of all the suffering that goes on because people believe that their rites and rituals are the correct ones, the only correct ones, because it says here right in my book, these are the only correct ones. And all those other people are wrong. You know, it can be absurd, where, you know, there's a great schism in Christianity based on simply the idea that the body, the wine and the bread used in communion, one group of people said it's just representative of the blood and the body of Christ. Another group said, no, once the priest has blessed them, they are the body and the blood of Christ. They've actually been transformed. And this created wars and battle, huge upheaval, because this is one hand, there's this rite and ritual, which is the same rite and ritual, but two different beliefs of what it meant, just what it meant. So that's one thing that's all still going on in our world today. But even if you're not, quote, traditionally religious, think of all the sort of cultural stuff around being spiritual. And Boulder, I live in Boulder, so Boulder is full of this idea that there are this the right kind of spiritual things to do, what you wear, how you eat, what kind of yoga you do. Oh no, my yoga is better than your yoga, and on and on. But these are just beliefs and rites and rituals in the modern spiritual culture, and cause equally difficult things to arise for people, because I found the perfect form of spiritual practices and I cling to it because it's comforting that I've found the right thing. That's the danger of all these things, is that it can be very comforting to feel like I've got it figured out. I know this way of acting, this set of rites and rituals in my life are the right ones. And we cling to them. And I'm not saying that rites and rituals in and of themselves are bad. You know, it's not, there's nothing wrong with going to mass or all those sorts of things that people like to do, or going and sitting with a sitting group, for that matter, which can become a rite and a ritual. As long as you don't believe it's the only right way and you have to have it now, and this is it forever and ever, this is what's important, this is the way it's got to be. It's when that way of thinking creeps in, when we start clinging to it, that the trouble arises. I mean, some rites and rituals are quite beautiful. When you see them and are part of them, they're quite uplifting, wholesome, beautiful things. So when we start clinging to them, believing that this is the only right way, and not only that, it's the only right way for me, and if I don't have this, it's going to be horrible. Because that's going to change. Because everything changes, including even rites and rituals, for that matter. You know, we think the rituals we perform are exactly the same way they were performed 500 years ago. Probably not even close to being right. Yeah, because things have evolved and the culture's evolved over 500 years. And those rituals that we think are time-tested and time-worn, and this is the way it's always been, not a chance. Not a chance. So that's the third thing we cling to that we have to be aware of. Then we come to the last of the things that we cling to, and this is the most difficult one to grasp and the most difficult one to deal with, and that is this sense we have of a separate self. We cling to the idea that somehow I'm separate from everyone else, that I have this permanent, ongoing self that's separate and different from everyone else. I'm going to read a little Joseph Goldstein here again. And he's talking about this very topic. The fourth of the bonds and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to a belief in a self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome action, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves around it, tying the bonds even tighter and tighter. It's a really important line. Our attachment, our clinging to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves around it. So this is the deepest of the things we cling to, this sense of this separate self. I want to read one other thing. This is from another one of Joseph's books. This is from Mindfulness. And he's talking about this specifically, about what he calls the desire to be. The craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, while they are often mentioned in the Buddhist teachings, but we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind. This is one of my favorite places to get lost. We can see this in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, then weeks or months or even years later, the whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. So think about this in terms of, I think this is really a relevant thing to read and think about, given our certain current situation in the world and in our lives, where we all have been, our lives have changed quite radically. You know, we've been living in this sort of very closed, carefully constructed world that we've had to live in to protect ourselves from the pandemic. And how often in that time have our thoughts, how have our thoughts come up to be, oh, I wish things were the way they used to be, or I can't wait till this is over, or I can't wait till things are back to normal. This is projecting into the future and creating a sense of self in the future. And of course, the truth is, we don't have a clue. And I'm not saying we shouldn't plan and figure out things, you know, yes, I really do want to go visit my kids in the summer sometime, so I'm going to have to sort of figure out what, you know, get flights and do all that. I mean, we have to be able to do that stuff. But it's like we cling to those ideas of how things are going to be. Out there at some future time. And when they don't turn out that way, which they pretty much never do, then we suffer. Because we've had this whole sense of, in a sense, happiness based on this idea of how things are going to be. And then it doesn't happen that way. And instead of just like being, well, this is what's happening now, and this is okay, and I'll go on with this. Now it's not really what I thought was going to happen at all. You know, I thought it's going to go visit, but then they, you know, some variant of COVID came up and they closed all the airports again. Nothing I can do about that. And I can either be really unhappy or I can go, well, now that's what's happening. You know, if I cling to the idea that that's how it's going to be, that's how this I is going to project into the future, then we're going to just create untold suffering for ourselves and for others who we're convincing it's going to be that way too. So this whole idea of clinging to things, basically, you know, what the second noble truth says is this clinging to all these layers of things, that's the cause of suffering. That's the cause of unsatisfactoriness. Just that, nothing else. It's the clinging, the process of clinging, of grasping and holding on to things really tightly, whether on the physical level or on the mental level or on the emotional level, even on the spiritual level. That's the root of it all. That's what the second noble truth talks about. There's a great teaching story about this. And actually it's based on how in Southeast Asia in particular, there's this whole thing about capturing monkeys. And there's a way, something called a monkey trap that they use to make this happen. And what they do is they take a coconut and they hollow it out and they cut a hole in the end of the coconut at one end, and they attach some, you know, piece of rope or something so that, you know, that it won't come out. And then at the other end, they put a hole that's just barely big enough for a monkey to slide its hand into the coconut. And then what they do is they put something inside the coconut that the monkey really will want. And what happens, of course, is, you know, the monkey sees the big treat in there, reaches his hand in and grabs the thing. But now its hand's a bit bigger because it's holding this thing in its hand. And it can't get its hand out of the coconut. It's trapped. And it's only trapped because of its desire. It's clinging to it, it's wanting that thing, and then clinging to it. And that monkey gets captured. This is us, day after day after day. One monkey trap after another. We keep suffering. We keep finding things unsatisfactory because we can't let go. We can't let go of that thing we really want. Or we can't let go of that sense of I'm right and you're wrong. We can't let go of this way of doing things is right and this way is doing things wrong. We can't let go of this idea that I'm somehow separate. We cling to them and we're caught. And this doesn't mean if we sort of stop clinging that everything's going to be wonderful in life. It doesn't mean that we're not going to still have the physical and emotional ups and downs of life. Because that's inevitable too. you know, 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. That's how things work. You know, this is, that's not going to change. But if we choose to react skillfully instead of clinging, if we choose to accept as opposed to cling, then that second dart that we talked about last week never gets flung. We're dealing with the world as it is. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. That's just natural. As long as we don't cling, we don't stick the second dart in that makes the suffering much worse. That's the basis of the second noble truth. And this requires mindfulness. This is why we practice mindfulness so much, because if we're mindful, then we can actually see ourselves clinging to things. We can start to see that opinion that underlies that sense of correctness and rightness, and I'm right and you're wrong, or this is the right way to do it, or this is the way I like it this way better. Even I like it this way better sometimes is just a view and opinion. Very recently, I finally gave up putting milk in my coffee. I'd been drinking milk in my coffee for 50 years, something like 55 years. And my view is that I couldn't drink milk without coffee. It's just an opinion, a view. And I drink black coffee and nothing else. And it's like, that's okay. And it was just like this idea I had that I had to have that white stuff in my coffee. And in fact, I wasn't even drinking dairy milk. I was putting in like rice milk or soy milk, but I had to turn it white and change it somehow. That was an opinion I held really deeply. Then we ran out of rice milk, and I was drinking coffee for 3 or 4 days with just plain old black coffee. And it was like, oh, this is okay. Just had to give up that opinion that's the way things should have to be. And now I just drink black coffee. Yeah, no big deal. One of these days, now, of course, I have the view that I need coffee. Just another layer of views and opinions. We're not ready for that one yet. But at least I can drink the black stuff, okay? Anyhow, that's just a personal example. But this is where this practice takes us, to going to understanding that it's not life itself, it's the clinging to the things that causes the suffering. I mean, inevitably there's going to be this unpleasantness, and inevitably there's going to be discomfort. Inevitably we're going to get old, we're going to get sick, we're going to die. That's inevitable. We can't avoid that. But we can avoid the idea that, you know, that's horrible. You know, that, oh, I can't die because then this sense of this separate self is going to disappear. Oh my God, can't have that. And that's the deeper level of that clinging to the sense of self of wanting to be, oh, but it's okay because I'm going to come back in another life. Well, actually, no, you, this personality, is not what's going to, if anything comes back, it isn't going to be you, the separate self that you have this idea of who you are. That's not what comes back at all. The energy, perhaps, of the goodness in your life comes back in some way, in another form, totally different than this you. This personality is gone. It's the way things are. Okay, so that's really all I have to say to you next week. Next week is the next exciting episode, the third Noble Truth, which not surprisingly, I'm not stealing my story at all here, is if you want to stop suffering, stop clinging. But then that's putting it way too simply. And so the whole talk is about, well, what does that mean and how do you possibly do that? More, what does that mean? What does it mean to stop clinging? other than, you know, because it seems like, yeah, well, sure, you want me to stop clinging? Yeah. But the Buddha had a lot to say about that. And that's what the whole talk next week is going to be about. Other than that, see you soon. Bye, Sammy. Thanks for coming.